From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! The day after on Democracy Now!, a look at election results across the nation with a special focus on progressive candidates. Also, how did mainstream media cover these campaigns? And a report from our voting rights activists in the South. All that and more here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! And this is Democracy Now!, sitting in for Amy Goodman. I'm Laura Flanders. This is going to be an Election Day report, but first, these headlines, starting, of course, with the results. Republicans lost their hold on governor's seats in California and four other states. The GOP retained control of Congress, but their already slim margin was trimmed in the House. In the Senate, the Republicans have made no headway. Earlier, Republican expectations of big gains in both chambers were blown away. Election Day's most unusual outcome was the upset victory by former professional wrestler Jesse "The Body" Ventura as governor of Minnesota, running under the Reform Party banner. Republican brothers Jeb and George W. Bush won the governorships in Florida and Texas, respectively. Democrat Gray Davis won the governorship in California, ending 16 years of GOP control. Democrats also won Republican governorships in Alabama and South Carolina, and also picked up Iowa. The GOP, in turn, took over Nebraska and Nevada from the Democrats, but lost their hold on Minnesota to Ventura. The first African-American woman ever elected to the Senate, Democrat Carol Mosley Braun, was defeated in Illinois by wealthy state Senator Pete Fitzgerald. On the Republican side, Alphonse D'Amato was defeated in New York by Democratic Representative Charles Schumer in the nation's nastiest and costliest Senate race. Republican Senate Lou Faircloth lost in North Carolina to trial lawyer John Edwards. It was a discouraging day for Republicans in the House, too, where House Speaker Newt Gingrich once talked of adding 30 to 40 GOP seats. Instead, Democrats picked up a handful of seats, defying the trend since World War II. That is the trend that the party controlling the White House loses an average of 27 House seats and 4 Senate seats in midterm elections. Republicans won 223 seats, down 5 from their 228 in the current Congress. Democrats, who now hold 206, had won 210 and were leading in one more in Oregon at last look. The House's lone independent, Representative Bernie Sanders of Vermont, also was reelected. In the Senate, it appears Republicans would hold their 55 to 45 advantage over Democrats. Meanwhile, on referendum votes nationwide, Michigan voters rejected physician-assisted suicide. Voters in Washington state approved an initiative to outlaw affirmative action in state hiring, contracting, and higher education. Proposals to legalize medical marijuana were approved in Nevada, Arizona, and Washington state. Hawaii and Alaska passed anti-gay marriage measures by 2-to-1 margins. And Washington and Colorado voters rejected a ban on late-term abortions. And finally, heading into the 1990s at last, the 1890s, that is, South Carolina erased a ban on interracial marriages. In Wisconsin, there was an election of the first openly gay woman to Congress, Tammy Baldwin. A Democratic state representative from Wisconsin defeated Republican Josephine Musser, the former state insurance commissioner, to replace retiring GOP Representative Scott Clark. Well, we're going to have more on all of that in just a moment, but first, a few other headlines. Lawyers for British and Spanish prosecutors today argued that the crimes committed during General Augusto Pinochet's rule in Chile, including the slayings of children and torture, are beyond legal immunity. The lawyers appealed to Britain's highest court, the House of Lords, to overturn a ruling last week that the former dictator's October 16th arrest on a Spanish warrant was illegal. The hearing, expected to last 2 days, opened today before a 5-judge tribunal drawn from the House of Lords. That's the unelected chamber of parliament made up of hereditary and appointed members. A former military ruler announced today that he will seek the presidential nomination of one of Nigeria's major political parties, General Obasanjo Trudeau, who handed over power in 1979 after an election ended his three-year rule, said he hopes to run for president on the ticket of the People's Democratic Party. Many human rights activists have criticized Obasanjo's presidential ambitions, saying that a campaign by a former soldier would dilute the transfer of power from Nigeria's long-ruling military to civilians. Meanwhile, members of the Joint Action Committee on Nigeria continue their campaign to boycott the country's elections, saying that the military cannot continue to transition itself out of power. The ghastly toll of Hurricane Mitch swelled to an estimated 9,000 dead today as rotting bodies were pulled out of swirling rivers and drying mudslides. Hundreds of thousands were left homeless, and they grew more desperate by the hour for food and water. Some 7,000 deaths occurred there in Honduras, where 11,000 people remain missing. And finally, Israeli warplanes attacked southern Lebanon today, firing two missiles at Lebanese villages. The airstrike is the fourth in 3 days. Israel says it was hitting suspected Hezbollah targets. Well, today we will be looking at the outcome of yesterday's midterm elections, this the day after. I'm Laura Flanders, sitting in for Amy Goodman, in case you were wondering. Strong gains by Democrats defied most of the predictions, but that didn't stop the pundits. We'll be looking at the media coverage later. And Republicans everywhere are struggling to explain their defeats. With us in the studio are two people who've been following the race very closely. First, we'll go to Bob Henley, our campaign correspondent, who's been analyzing the election campaign and now has his analysis of the results. What do you make of everything, Bob?
I think that the far-right Republican right-wing is been totally dismissed right now, and it really creates a situation where it has implications even within the Republican Party, where moderates like Christy Todd Whitman, who's pro-choice, now is going to find her hand strengthened, because the Faircloth in North Carolina, the defeat of Fob James, who's very close to the Christian Coalition in Alabama, the South Carolina situation with Hodges taking Beasley and Hollings holding on against Bob Inglis, who's another Christian Coalition Centurion. Clearly, all around the country where the Republican Party was really extreme, it just lost. Anywhere where it wanted to project into controlling a woman's prerogatives, it was dismissed by the voters. In fact, in New Jersey, in a late-breaking story, it's amazing, in the 12th Congressional District, which is in the center of the state, Somerset County area, Congressman Michael Pappas, Republican, very far right, very much anti-choice, also found himself defeated, even though in today's Times, for instance, they claim that he beat Rush Holt, the Democrat challenger, who's a physics professor. It turns out that the county clerk inverted the numbers, and all of the media reported that Pappas had won. This means the Jersey delegation goes from being 7 Republicans and 6 Democrats to 7 Democrats and 6 Republicans.
Now, that's obviously something of a bellwether race. Do you have other races that you think are as clear, send as clear a message as those? Which would stand
Well, I think
out
the
in
fact in general that we're going to have to sort it out, but the fact that Congressman Spratt held on in South Carolina in a very tough race is indicative that what happened here was that the African-American and Latino vote came out in force, and it actually amplified their actual voting strength, because in general, it wasn't like voter turnout was stunning around the country. It was just that for once, the left and progressive coalition got the jump on the Christian coalition and was motivated. And that was something that wasn't anticipated. But really, I hate to keep coming back to this, the real heartbreak for the Democratic Party has to be the fact that there were these 96 uncontested House races, with 60 of them being Republicans. I think you could make the argument that perhaps had they been able to mount campaigns in all of the seats, they probably would have won back Congress.
Now, talking about minority voters, so-called, came out in strength in Texas and Florida for the Bush brothers.
Exactly. But also, and there was some heartbreak for the Democrats in New Mexico, particularly Mr. Johnson, a Republican, held on against Mr. Chavez, a former mayor of Albuquerque, despite the fact that 40% of the voters are Latino in New Mexico. So clearly, though, and in the case of Florida, that's a special case, because the Democratic Party locally seriously erred when they didn't permit a prominent African-American legislator to take his position as Speaker of the state legislature, and he sided with Mr. Bush. He did his own calculus, which I think shows a kind of kind of sophistication in what's going on in terms of politics. People of color are going to make their decision based on how they're treated by the party. And in point of fact, it raises their, I think, their importance even more because they're not going to be taken for granted anymore.
And the big picture, I mean, just for a moment to rub the nose of the pundits in it, the expectations about the Senate, for example,
right,
have obviously not been met. And what about the House? What do you make of what's happened there?
Well, I think what's happened, I mean, that's really unprecedented. I mean, we have to give the Democratic Party its due. I mean, the thing that comes into mind is President Clinton is like Roadrunner and Newt Gingrich is like Wile E. Coyote. It seems that he successfully reinvented himself. But the problem here is that the Democratic Party that won is not necessarily a united Democratic Party. And the question is, where does it go from there? Does it take on a more progressive agenda, or is it going to take on the more corporatist DLC agenda? And that's really hasn't been resolved yet. I mean, is this going to be perceived as a mandate, for instance, for Gore, where he just ascends to the nomination without any kind of discussion about what kind of agenda we're going to pursue?
Well, that segues very nicely to our next guest, producer of Democracy Now! Here, Jeremy Scahill, who was following the Chuck Schumer victory party last night here in New York, where one of the biggest defeats for the Republicans took place with the defeat of longtime Republican Senator Alphonse D'Amato, and it was an incredibly costly campaign, I think one of the most costly in history, and nasty to boot. You were there for the victory party, or were you, Jeremy?
Well, I was sort of there.
What was that again?
Well, I was sort of there. Yes, indeed, I did go for Pacifica to cover the election race at Chuck Schumer's spot at the lush Waldorf Astoria. And I was locked out of the event. They would not let me into the actual event, so I had to file my stories from the lobby of the Waldorf Astoria. But I wasn't the only one that was locked out. When I first got there, there were picketers out front from ABC. They were from ABC television crews and behind-the-scene camera crews. And they were picketing the event that night. And they say that they felt snubbed by Chuck Schumer, who crossed a picket line yesterday to do an interview with ABC. Al Gore canceled an interview. Barbara Boxer's people in California would not let the ABC camera crew in until ABC threatened them with a court order. Pacifica was not let in. We were not the only ones locked out. There were people out in front. And we've been covering this ABC strike on Democracy Now!
The strike
here.
Over the right to full information about the health insurance policy.
Their health insurance
policy. They've been denied so far by the Disney Corporation.
Right, and there was no explanation given to me while I was locked out, so I did file a story from the where the strikers were picketing and leafleting out in front of the event. And it's interesting because I got a chance to talk to Joel Covell, the Green Party candidate, last night from Chuck Schumer's headquarters, and he was saying that it's really no...
group of industries. In fact, Schumer was the architect, one of the architects of the savings and loan bailout, which is another great transfer of wealth. So Mr. Covell may have a point.
Well, let's go next to two people who were monitoring poll booths and got the vote out yesterday in Alabama and South Carolina, two places where Southern Democrats regained governorships and staged a kind of comeback, thanks in large measure to larger-than-predicted turnouts among black voters. One of them is someone we spoke to yesterday as we looked at the outlook for the election. The other is John Zippert, who is co-publisher of the Greene County Democrat in Utah, Alabama, and co-chair of the Alabama Black Belt Defense Committee, which has been at work defending voting rights activists who were indicted and convicted for supposed voter fraud in that region in the last few years. John Zippert, first to you. What actually went down there in Greene County, and is there any contentious question about, I believe, some ballots have still been invalidated up to now?
Well, in Greene County, we had a strong turnout of black voters yesterday, and I think across the state of Alabama, we had a strong turnout of black voters, which contributed to the victory of the Democratic governor, but we still have two races, the lieutenant governor and the attorney general, that are still, you know, still undecided this morning. 90-some percent of the precincts have been counted in both races, and the candidates are less than 10,000 votes apart statewide out of about 1.5 million votes. So it's not clear yet of the outcome. In Greene County, we had reduced turnout in terms of absentee voting, which has been an issue in our county, where people have been indicted and convicted for supposed fraud in past elections. And, for instance, we had 238 absentee ballots in this election in 98, and we had 1,000 in 94, just as an example. And of the total number of 261 absentee ballots, 10% of them were disqualified because people didn't check off their reason for voting and didn't have the proper witnesses on the ballot. So 10% of the people who took the time and trouble to vote absentee, the procedure was so complicated that their votes were not counted. And I think that's an example where, in an effort to prevent fraud, really people have gone overboard in preventing people from really using their vote and discouraging people from using the opportunity to vote absentee, elderly people, sick people, people who work outside of the county, students. So this remains a continuing battle in Greene County and the Alabama Black Belt to give people the full chance to vote and the full opportunity to turnout voters.
One of the questions that Bob Henley has here in the studio with me is, why has there been a decline in the absentee ballots that you're talking about?
Well, we've had prosecutions during the last 2 years of community activists who've been involved in helping people to cast absentee ballots in past elections. We have heavily contested elections. We're in a part of the Alabama Black Belt where black people are in the majority in these counties. We have had cases where we've had over 70% turnouts in many of these counties, aided by a campaign to make sure everyone who can cast a ballot does. Now we have the Republican Attorney General, the Republican senators in Alabama fighting against the use of the absentee ballot by black voters. And we have had indictments and in some cases convictions of people who in the 94 election worked hard to get their neighbors to vote absentee. We have two people in Greene County, Connie Tyree and Frank Smith, who are facing 33 months in jail basically for helping 250 of their neighbors to vote in that election.
Just to establish the kind of unusual nature of this, there is so little, it's so rare for prosecutions for voter fraud in general that people have to keep that in mind nationally. It's one of the most under-prosecuted things. So here you have a very unusual development.
Mm-hmm. Just one point to make from your story, John Zippert, is that clearly there is a lot going on in Alabama beyond the discussion of the state lottery, which was held accountable in most national coverage for the turnaround in the governor's race in that state.
Well, I think it went beyond the lottery. I think the current governor kind of appeal to Christian conservative voters, the right wing. His main platform was the return of prayer to the schools. And the Democratic candidates, I think, ran on truly more populist position of making sure that education in Alabama means something, and the lottery was a means of getting some resources to that. It's unfortunate in some ways that they have still not talked about the real underlying issue, which is that the tax system in Alabama is inequitable, that it favors large corporations
over individuals. Thanks, John. We'll be right back in 60 seconds. We're going to take a break.
On the oceans and upon our seas, fish full of mercury. Oh, oh, mercy, mercy, me. All things ain't what they used to be. Radiation underground and in the sky, animals and birds who live nearby.
This is Democracy Now! Sitting in for Amy Goodman. I'm Laura Flanders. With us on the line from South Carolina is Reverend J.M. Fleming, someone we spoke to yesterday. He was going to be involved in a Get the Vote Out campaign. Reverend Fleming, how did it work down there in South Carolina? We know the result, but what happened on the ground?
Well, I think what took place here is that the black community made a statement to this state, to the county and city, is that we are going to be a power to reckon with from henceforth. What we done, we had to go door to door and get people out, and we had a great increase in absentee voting from the black community this time that we haven't had in the past. I think that the educational issue brought a lot of voters out. Matter of fact, I know that's what brought us out, because we had a governor, and under this governor, we dropped below two states in education, so it affected us in many ways. And so all we had to do was to point out the issues to our constituents and get them out. And that's what we've done.
Tell me more about Jim Hodges, the governor's candidate who actually turned out David Beasley last night.
Well, guess what? Hodges has a good program, has a good platform to work from. He was saying the things that we wanted to hear, and he's been working and doing those kinds of things that we want someone to do for us, and that is to work for education for all of our children in the state of South Carolina. And believe it or not, that issue alone pushed him ahead of everybody else. He was talking about education for all the students in South Carolina, not just one particular group of students, but all the students, coming up with funds to help with grants, Pell grants and whatnot for students and stuff. So those are the kinds of things we wanted to hear here in South Carolina, and that's what it took to get us motivated to get us out to the polls.
All right, and what about the harassment that we talked about yesterday that you were fearful of, police presence at the polling booths and so on?
We did not have the kind of problems that we anticipated, but we had only one problem, and that was them trying to close the polls at 7 o'clock, and yet we had more than 1,000 and some people still in line. We happen to have a person here from Washington who was sent from to watch the polls and whatnot, and as soon as we got them involved, and it was resolved within a matter of 30 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, it's something that they wanted to close the polls and say, I mean, you got all these people lined up around the streets and everything else out here, and they would not allow that to take place. Had it taken place, we probably would have lost maybe, I guess, between 1,800 and 2,000 votes last night. So I think that we're thankful that we had somebody watching the polls from a national level opposed to just counting on the folk here at the local level.
So a good message to the Justice Department that when they send their inspectors out, there actually can be an effect.
Oh, yeah. It
All
is.
Right.
We thank them for that.
All right. That's the Reverend J.M. Fleming, the chairperson of Concerned Citizens for Equal Justice in Greenville, South Carolina. He was accompanied by John Zippert from the Alabama Black Belt Defense Committee in Utah, Alabama. With us on the line from Washington now is Karen Dolan of the Institute for Policy Studies, who will be helping us discuss how candidates with a more progressive agenda did nationwide. We just heard from John Zippert and Reverend Fleming that the issues that seem to speak to the more progressive, you know, more progressive portion of the population came across clear and motivated people out to the polls at least as much as any national question did. Karen Dolan, on a national level, how did the candidates who fall inside the category of the progressive caucus do on a national front?
Good morning, Laura.
Yeah.
They did great. It was just terrific. Aside from being sleep deprived here, we're all very excited and encouraged about how the progressives did nationwide. We were monitoring specifically progressive races, and we knew we'd get six, and we were hoping for 10, but it turns out we got 13. And we got some gains on Republican seats, and overall it was just an exciting night. It's encouraging. It represents a shift within the Democratic Party in the House. It presents lots of potential for moving forward a more progressive agenda on the Hill itself, for increasing support for progressive agenda among the voters nationwide. So overall, it was very, very positive for us, and especially for those of us who are trying to work to link progressive agendas of grassroots groups and activists and citizens and so forth with progressive policymakers. It's a strong statement for progressive policymakers that they can stand up on these agendas, and these are the agendas that are going to win. The new seats that the Democrats got are they're progressive Democrats who got those seats.
Now tell us take us through a little bit candidate by candidate and remind our listeners what you look for when you talk about membership within the progressive caucus. What are the litmus test issues?
Well, we were using as our gauge, and we have been using for about a year and a half now, something called the Fairness Agenda for America. And that's an 8-point multi-issue agenda that was crafted with input from progressive organizations, scholars, so forth, and the members and staff of the Congressional Progressive Caucus of the 105th Congress. And so we, using that as a litmus test, if you will, we gathered campaign information for various candidates and matched their agendas up with the Fairness Agenda. And those who had very similar agendas, we categorize as progressives.
So you're talking about issues
and
like free trade, like the fast track, affirmative action, abortion. What other issues fall?
That's right. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and support for public education, universal health care, shifting budgetary priorities from the military to social spending, affirmative action, women's rights, sustainable communities,
mm-hmm.
And campaign finance reform.
And
the final poll
on the candidates, give us a sense of what kind of people came out on top yesterday. Give us some names and places.
Well, we're really excited about Tammy Baldwin. A lot of people are excited about Tammy Baldwin. She ran a very great grassroots campaign. She mobilized thousands of people out on primary day. She's the first openly gay person elected to Congress, and the first woman elected from Wisconsin, I believe. And she was very strong on universal health care, public education, the environment, living wage, women's rights, and she ran a very strong grassroots campaign. I don't think she took any corporate money for her race. And she, along with Jan Schakowsky, who's another great activist progressive, I can see them as being great potential leaders in the House, very activist, very strong on their agendas. We had There's Mike Capuano, who took the 8th Congressional District in Massachusetts, who's strong on education and Social Security, supports campaign finance reform. Campaign finance reform was very strong in a lot of these candidates who ran. And there, you know, there's 13, I suppose, our spokespeople, in a sense, are these activist women,
Karen,
that came out so strong.
Karen Dolan, the issues,
yes,
that you're talking about weren't just on the campaign platforms of the candidates. They also appeared on many ballots as propositions, as ballot measures. How about the results of those around the country? Affirmative action, of course, was struck down in Washington State, and gay marriage went down in Alaska and Hawaii. It's an odd contradiction. It seems that the ballot measures on issues that the progressive candidates supported did not fare as well as the candidates themselves.
Well, that's true, but it's always a tricky question when you're talking about the ballot initiatives. On the one hand, in some states and some cities, it can be a strong kind of direct democracy and participation of the citizens. But on the other hand, you get a huge influx of money from the Christian right, let's say, to knock down some of these propositions. And it becomes, in a sense, again, the question of money in politics.
Isn't it also
and
how they're drafted?
This is Bob Henley,
right,
Pacifica Radio's election commentator.
Isn't also the way the language, for instance, in the Washington ballot question, it wasn't it kind of deceptive with the way that it was drawn?
Well, I'm not so familiar with all the ballot initiatives to be able to comment on that, except to say that a lot of those factors, of course, go into it, the media play and so forth. But I do think that one of the crucial elements to look at is what kind of special interests were contributing, what kind of money,
mm-hmm,
you know, how far away from the democratic system we come with those initiatives.
Well, with us on the line now from San Diego is someone who's been watching both some of the ballot initiatives and the candidates from the perspective of gay and lesbian issues. He's Brian Bond from the Victory Fund. Brian, we just talked a little bit about Tammy Baldwin, an interesting and successful candidacy in Wisconsin. What have you made of last night's results, and what stand out in your mind as indications of how the public are viewing this question when it comes down to gay and lesbian rights?
Well, first of all, not to trumpet our own horn a little bit here, but the word historic, it's 6 o'clock in the morning here, so I woke up and it's like, wow, history has been made. You know, not only has Wisconsin elected the first openly gay non-incumbent to office, but the first lesbian as well, and the first woman, I believe, from Wisconsin. I think overall, I mean, if you look at the districts where candidates were running, and again, I think you have to be careful because you do have to pick the districts where a candidate can run, and you do have to have candidates who philosophically can match the district. But overall, I think, you know, in the races that we were watching, Tammy Baldwin, Christine Kehoe, and Greta Cammermeyer, that, you know, people were more than willing to move past the issue of sexual orientation and, you know, much like the other campaigns, finally in the last 2 weeks get down to the issues. It's in Christine Kehoe's case, we're still waiting. While I think the election board here has called that race Bilbray 49, Kehoe 46, there are less than 5,000 votes between them, and apparently there is about no less than 20,000 absentee ballots yet to be counted.
And Christine Kehoe is in which district?
That's in
San Diego.
San Diego's 49th district. It's a evenly split Democratic Republican district held by a two-term Republican incumbent at this point,
mm-hmm,
Congressman Bilbray, and it was clearly in this district based on quote effectiveness in Washington. Sexual orientation did not play into this one really at all.
Now, what do you make of the Greta Cammermeyer race? And one of the reasons that we thought it would be interesting to look at gay and lesbian candidates was that this has been, on a national level, so much a campaign dominated by talk of honesty in personal behavior. And Margaret Cammermeyer had been someone who'd been able to say, look, I'm Clinton-proof. I've been through the mill of mudslinging and, negative campaigning and have come out to get surprising amount of support by being honest about who I am and what I am in a way that it seemed it had some national relevance or resonance or could have had.
In Greta Kammermeier's case, first of all, she is, again, is not what I would call, quote, a liberal. I know a lot of people want to say if somebody's gay or lesbian, they've got to be a liberal, and that's certainly not the case for Greta Kammermeier. So, you know, in many ways, she, again, reflected many of the views of her district. I would say the Republican in that race, Congressman Metcalf, did actually do a little gay baiting early on by sending out a huge mailing saying that she wanted to bring her lesbian agenda to Washington. He kind of got slapped for that and pretty much stayed away from that from then on. You know, I mean, for her, I'm showing with 99%, her with 45% of the vote. And I think, you know, a lot of people in Washington counted her out come the first part of September. So most of the money she raised was actually from individuals. She came into this race with really no name ID in the district other than those few who did know her said, oh, that's the lesbian that got kicked out of the military or that they made that movie about. So by the time she started working her way through the district, you know, she was able to focus on her true love in life, which is health care. Mm. And I got to tell you, I think she built up a lot of goodwill and respect in that district. I think what probably killed her in the end, well, there are probably three things. One, the fact that, again, a lot of the Washington types pretty much said, no, she can't win, and we only have X number of dollars. But two, you know, she had never run for public office before. And in the case of Tammy Baldwin and Chris Kehoe, they were both Victory Fund candidates elected to state rep and city council spots that are much more manageable and easier to get your hands around and win. So they were a little more prepared to go into, you know, this whole campaign cycle. And I think, you know, I remember when Greta first announced, I think she was kind of struck at awe that the press took literally everything you say and write it, and then you have to deal with that because of what you said, and without kind of thinking it through, and almost I hate to say the word spin, but you know, I think there are just so many things she wasn't prepared for, and it was a long learning curve for her.
Brian Bond from the Victory Front, I know we don't have much more time with you. I want to ask you to address two other situations, namely Hawaii and Alaska, the votes on gay marriage, so-called.
Wait, I don't have the final numbers on this. Do you have those at this point?
I don't have the final numbers, but there were what are being referred to on the wires as 2-1 votes against gay marriage.
Yeah, that was a hard situation. We were obviously focused just on candidates. But you have a situation where, and I believe if you look at Alaska, for instance, that the Mormon Church actually supposedly put $500,000 in that race or in that issue, and you know the marriage issue is going to take some time. I kind of go back to the candidates here for a second. When you have Christine Kehoe running in San Diego County, basically, which there's almost three, you know, in the TV media market here, probably around 2.5 million people. Maybe close to 1 million where Greta was running, and maybe close to 1 million where Tammy was running, and then you throw in some of the other candidates out there. I mean, it's going to take an education process here, and when you have Christine Kehoe on TV nonstop talking about issues and people know the fact that she's an open lesbian, I think that breaks down a lot of barriers. So, and it's extremely disappointing about Hawaii and Alaska, but I think a lot of things like corporations, you know, opening the doors to domestic partnership benefits and candidates running for office. And, yeah, we will lose some of these ballot issues for a while, but I think this is an education process, and you know, and I think it's historic, and I think it's people are coming around, and
Brian,
it's very exciting.
Brian Bond of the Victory Fund has been on the phone with us from San Diego. Thank you for taking the time to be here on Democracy Now! Karen Dolan, I'd like to keep you on the line from the Institute for Policy Studies, but return right now to Bob Henley, Pacifica's election commentator. Bob, we're looking at the Progressive Caucus candidates and gay and lesbian candidates, I think because of the point that Brian just made, that we're talking about people who are breaking down barriers.
Right.
Now, this, in an off-term election, where we've seen advances on both progressive agenda and even some of the more difficult candidates historically, namely gay and lesbian candidates. This is, we've used the word historic, but what do you make of the relevance of this for ongoing politics now and organizing the day after the day after?
Well, certainly I would not be discouraged if I was Kammermeyer. I think that considering that she has not had any electoral history, that this would be a tremendous encouragement for her. I mean, consider that there was no funding coming from Washington, that this was something that was done pretty much all locally. And I think also, let's look on the other side of it. In Washington, Colorado, there was a rejection of proposals to restrict late-term procedures, late-term abortions. Similarly, environmental issues passed. In South Dakota, voters tightened restrictions on corporate farming. Also, we had Oregon rejecting limits on forest clear-cutting. Now, that was goes back the other way. Then you see in Montana they approved a ban on cyanide in new gold mining projects. So it's not the thing about these ballot initiatives is that the way they're often cast is obscures what their real meaning is. So there has to be tremendous grassroots education to get through the legalese so people understand the implication of what they're voting for.
And Karen Dolan, let's talk about implications. Let's talk about implications as soon as we come back. We're actually going to take a 60-second break right now. You're listening to Democracy Now. This is Democracy Now! I'm Laura Flanders. Karen Dolan's been with us on the line from the Institute for Policy Studies, been tracking how the Progressive Caucus did. Will this change? Will this election change, given the history? This election comes on the back of two others in which Progressive Caucus candidates did very well nationally. Will this change the habits of political pundits and those considering running in how they define candidates as viable, non-viable, and stands as radical and liabilities? Karen Dolan?
That I think that a lot of that depends upon us to some extent in the progressive community. What we really need to be working more closely with progressive candidates and get the message out there, both with our grassroots mobilizing, that a progressive agenda is really an agenda for working people in America, and that the progressive candidates are standing up for this, and that they exist, that they're there. For so long, the Progressive Caucus was kind of hidden. But I think with all of these successes that are consistent, and with us trying to give them more visibility and more confidence and do the educating work that we need to do, that possibility exists. It's still an uphill battle, but of course this goes a long way in furthering that goal.
Now, of course, one of the reasons that candidates are visible or invisible is how much attention mainstream media want to give those candidates and their issues. Someone who looks at that all the time is Jeff Cohen, executive director of FAIR, a former colleague of mine. Jeff, what about this defeat of so much of the radical conservative, social conservatives, Republican candidates last night, and the relative success of the Progressive Caucus, which, as I said, wasn't just this year, but has been the third year in a row?
Yeah, I don't know that it's going to rock the pundits. They seem very set in their ways. The funny thing last night was watching Fox News Channel, a channel, Laura, you and I have been on, that's probably one of the more right-leaning channels, and boy, it was somber over there. I mean, it's so biased over there. You had Tony Snow, the the right-wing columnist who sometimes has substituted for Rush Limbaugh on Limbaugh's radio show. He was playing objective reporter, analyzing exit polling. I'm not sure that anything can shake up these pundits. I was amazed at how little was said, besides that they were surprised by the results. Just all the misstatements. I mean, this morning while you were on the air with Democracy Now!, you had an expert on CNN who was asked about campaign finance. And he said, well, sure, in Wisconsin and Minnesota the issue plays, where Feingold won and the wrestler, Jesse the Body Ventura, and neither of them took big money. They had self-imposed limits. But it's not playing in the rest of the country. And you had no one there on the show to bring up that, yes, it is playing in the conservative state of Arizona. The very progressive clean money initiative, it passed, and it passed strongly. And Massachusetts clean money initiative passed by the state voters in a landslide. So I'm not sure anything can shake up the pundits. That's why outlets like Pacifica are so important in analyzing what really happened in the election yesterday.
I mean, pundits couldn't have been more wrong about turnout, about results. Did they ever have to say they're sorry?
No, that's the job of that's one of the perks of being a pundit, Laura, is you don't have to say you're sorry. I mean, the funniest stuff last night and this morning is the interrogation of Gingrich by the TV anchors and the correspondents. Last night, it was an interrogation. Brokaw and Gingrich sort of went at it on NBC. And Brokaw says, did the Republicans overplay the presidential scandal? And then Gingrich gave what I thought was a somewhat on-point response. Well, you and the media may have overplayed the presidential scandal. And then Brokaw raises it again. Is this a cause of defeat, the impeachment moves by the GOP? And Gingrich says, no, you and the media are fixated on it. And I've got to tell you, both of them are right. And there was no one in the news outlets last night or this morning to say it, that this was not just a rejection of Republicans in Congress. This wasn't very much a backlash against the mainstream media.
So, excuse me, this is Bob Henley. Yeah. I just wanted to note, I think you're probably familiar with this, up there in the District 26 in upstate New York around Woodstock, you have a case in point where incumbent Maurice Hinchey, a Democrat, very closely aligned with President Clinton. In fact, he was one of the very few white Democrats that aligned himself with the Black Caucus in that first vote to restrict dumping all of this Monica stuff onto the internet. And it looks like, if the Times is correct, he won 2-1 over the Republican William Walker, who's an apple farmer and, I guess, radio station magnate. And, I mean, that is just stunning. I mean, it's always been a close race.
I don't know if his name came up earlier when you discussed the Progressive Caucus. He's one of the most active progressives and one of the leaders of the Progressive Caucus. And he's in a conservative district. He runs on working class issues. He identifies himself with working class people and concerns. He's a militant opponent of NAFTA and a supporter of single-payer health care. He beat the Republican 2-1. He's a guy the Republicans have been trying to knock out time after time. He's also a major critic of corporate-owned mass media. So, I mean, there's some bright spots in this election. You won't know it, a lot of bright spots, a lot more than what you're getting from the mainstream media. And part of it is this unwillingness to look at that the system itself is flawed. I mean, the analysis on mainstream media doesn't go any deeper than which side won within the existing rigged rules. But, you know, something that Norman Solomon and I have been encouraging mainstream journalists to do for a long time is to do an analysis after each election of who won votes per dollar spent. Who won? You know, we got this idea in 1992 when Packwood in Oregon, D'Amato in New York, and Specter in Pennsylvania outspent their Democratic challengers 2 or 3-1 and narrowly eked in. Now, if the media had done a votes per dollar spent analysis, they would have realized that on a level playing field, D'Amato, Specter, Packwood would have been knocked out in 92. If you did this votes per dollar spent analysis last night and this morning, you would realize that even in the rigged system, voters turned to progressive and sometimes moderate liberal candidates. But if it were a balanced playing field, then American politics begins to really open up and the corporate special interests are defeated. That's what's so shocking. When you did have these victories of clean money in Arizona and Massachusetts, it was almost a blip in the mainstream media, when it may be the most significant thing that happened is that these victories, and if you can win in Arizona with clean money, which is serious campaign finance, it's way beyond McCain-Feingold, then you could go state by state, and that's exactly what Public Campaign, the organization in Washington that helped spur these statewide initiatives, that's what they plan on doing in coming elections.
Now, where does the campaign that has occurred in some parts of the country for free airtime for political candidates come out this morning? When you talk about the expense of campaign races, it's largely expense in buying TV money, TV airtime, which may be why some of the broadcasters don't want to talk about it. What happens to that campaign now? There's a report in the Wall Street Journal today that the new draft plan for digital television doesn't require digital TV broadcasters to give free airtime to candidates.
You know, I think that's another campaign reform that's going to be really on the agenda, because it's clear that when television decides who is a credible candidate and who isn't, who gets the airtime and who doesn't, it's the key decision made by anyone during that campaign. For example, Jesse the Body Ventura, it was decided, here was a guy who was only the mayor of a suburb. Rarely do mayors of suburbs get treated as legitimate candidates. He's also connected to that party that was started by the billionaire Ross Perot, the Reform Party. But because they let this guy in, who's a pretty articulate fellow, also a professional wrestler, which usually isn't something that gives you credibility as a mainstream candidate, but because the mass media gave him play, he was involved in the debates, you watched his numbers double and then double again, and he wins the election. Now, what if they did this in other states where they had to allow the Green into the debates, or they had to allow someone from the Working Families Party, a party that's trying to be formed in New York State? It just shows you that someone can come out of nowhere if they're allowed into the game and win the game. And it shows the power of the media in deciding who will be allowed in the club along with the Democrat and the Republican. And it's truly astounding in Minnesota that a guy comes out of virtually nowhere, his only elected office is a suburban mayor, and he won quite convincingly and defeated big money. And I think he was only taking $50 donations. But again, you don't need big money if the mainstream media is going to give you the same play that they're giving the Democrat and the Republican. And before you know it, the voters are saying, hey, why do we need the Democrats and Republicans? I'm voting for this third alternative. Mm-hmm. And I think it's really telling why media reform is so important as a component of campaign reform.
Somebody talked around here about Ventura leaving professional wrestling and going to the Congress as raising the ethical of average standards of both institutions.
Well, the funny, you know, it used to be said about the U.S. Senate, if he ever made it to the Senate, you know, it's a place where there's a lot of overweight white guys pretending to hurt each other, which is a little bit like professional wrestling.
Not the Congress, but the State House, of course.
Yeah.
Bob Hanley.
Yeah, I think that what's interesting here is
that let's keep in mind that there was over $330 million spent, if the Annenberg study is correct, from the University of Pennsylvania, by 67 veiled stealth issue advocacy groups that don't have to register anywhere, and that they really helped to drive the cost of this campaign close to $1 billion. And I think we would have a different story today if, indeed, the Democrats have been able to mount campaigns in the 60-some-odd districts where they couldn't even get a candidate because it's so expensive to run. And I think it's also important to keep in mind that there's been analysis that shows that the media does this as a money machine. They look at the political
Yep.
process as a way of getting ad revenue up. That's all it is. For every one report on Congress that's done, there are five ads that are played on the air for which they're getting money. Also, the campaign consultants receive a kickback, if you will, in the form of a percentage of the media buy from the media itself.
You're making such good points. FAIR has written some of this up, that the National Association of Broadcasters, a powerful lobby in Washington, also has power with the politicians because obviously they have a powerful member in every district known as a TV or radio station. And the NAB has lobbied against all campaign finance reform, especially free time, and the reason being that there's no greater beneficiary of our corrupt system as it stands now than television. Former Senator Bill Bradley from New Jersey has said that a statewide campaign is basically, if you're a Senate candidate, you are a collection agency for the broadcasters. You go to the special interests, collect the money, and then you hand it over to the TV stations.
Karen Dolan, listening to this discussion about media coverage, from the perspective of the Progressive Caucus candidates that you tracked, where do you see successes in breaking through these barriers of big media control? Karen?
You're talking about once they're in the House? Or?
No, on the campaign trail as you've followed it. Have you seen any examples of people who managed to break through this kind of stonewall?
Well, I think that the points that were brought up by our other two guests are the correct points to be made here. I don't know what I could add to that, but it's very important, again, to remember that the campaign finance reform initiatives did pass and that many of these candidates ran on that kind of an agenda, and that's accepted and they were elected. And that media reform does need to be a very strong component of any kind of campaign reform and any kind of progressive agenda. So just keeping that issue out there, again, educating people about it, educating the media in whatever way we can. All of this is an uphill battle, but we're making some ground.
Thank you, Karen Dolan of the Institute for Policy Studies in Washington, for being with us on the show. Jeff, you want to come in on that?
I just wanted to say that I know that in her work with the Progressive Caucus, this is a somewhat inspiring election for that. I really believe that there will be a lot of progressive energy unleashed in electoral work. And I think people who do electoral progressive activism are going to realize that part of the fight is going to be steering some of your electoral energy toward media reform. In any campaign where you run an outsider election, whether you're a Green or you're a Progressive Democrat or whatever, you're going to have to be bucking the media system at every step of the campaign, and that's a great thing. And we've shown this election, I think, shows you run against the media and run for media reform. It's helpful. And one footnote: Russ Feingold, who eked out the victory, even though he unilaterally disarmed financially in Wisconsin, the senator, he's a major proponent of corporate media demonopolization, antitrust. There's a lot of people that have retained their seats in the House and the Senate that really want to move on some of these media reform policy initiatives in Washington, and I think it's going to be a real battle, not just in the next 2 years, but in the next four.
Coming back to you, Bob Henley, for some final comments. I mean, this has been an extraordinary election, an off-season election, in terms of the media coverage, most people were looking in the wrong direction for what was going to happen yesterday. And as we did Democracy Now! Yesterday, it was clear that there was something happening out there in the nation that simply wasn't percolating through to public consciousness via broadcast media in particular. What is your final kind of comment to the public here, and what do you think this means for the future? Where do we go?
I think that clearly the thing people have to be concerned about is health care, and now they have their day because they went to the polls and they voted for candidates who want to have issues that are key to working families. And they have to do it pretty quickly because there's been over 96 HMOs that have pulled out of Medicare and Medicaid. The entire healthcare system is collapsing. In New Jersey, a major executive for HIP, a major HMO, committed suicide. The telecommunications issue is another area where, with the Republicans in control, they really gave an open field day, a carte blanche for the entire telecommunications industry.
Although the Democrats haven't been much better.
No, but at least now there's some ray of hope that we're going to hold them accountable because the progressives have gotten some leverage.
All right. Well, I'd like to thank all our participants on the program today. Jeff Cohen, Executive Director of FAIR, the New York-based Media Watch Group, and Bob Henley, who I can't thank enough for all of your work in the weeks preceding this one.
Thanks.
As a political commentator and researcher here for Pacifica Radio. You are listening to Democracy Now! On Pacifica Radio. My name is Laura Flanders, sitting in for Amy Goodman. For a copy of today's show or any other Democracy Now! Program, you can call the following toll-free number. It's 1-800 1-800-735-0230, 1-800-735-0230. If you'd like to reach us via email, our address is democracy@pacifica.org, democracy@pacifica.org. And you can hear us on the web at www.pacifica.org. And at that site, you'll probably find links to some of the organizations that we've been talking with today. Democracy Now!, as always, is produced by Jeremy Scahill and Maria Carrion. Errol Maitland is our technical director, Michelle Garcia, our web spinner. Julie Drizin is our executive producer. From the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Laura Flanders for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!